Welcome to Warm Regards, conversations from the front lines of climate change. I'm Jacqueline Gill, happy to be back, and still an assistant professor at the University of Maine. Joining me this week is Ramesh Langani, associate professor of biology at Doan University in Nebraska. Ramesh, it's really good to talk to you again. How have you been?
Yeah, things have been good. Busy, but good. Yeah, it's good to be co-hosting the show again with you. And I'm excited to talk with our guest today. I'm excited to talk about climate change with you again today.
When are we not excited to talk about climate change?
That's true. That is true.
Yeah, there's so much going on. And election is in full swing here. And I've actually been finding that climate change is coming up a lot, which is weird in general and weird for a midterm, too.
Yeah. You know, I've been chatting with my students recently about the latest IPCC report. You know, that's for another show for us to break that down. But those discussions have really led into some great discussions about climate policies on the ballot, like things in Washington. But overall, I know it's election season. So, you know, I'd like to be able to watch about 5 minutes of TV without seeing a political ad, but we'll get there.
Oh my gosh, yeah, we just have a few weeks left, and then it'll all be over. Yeah.
Right.
And since the last time you and I talked, there have been a couple of really intense hurricanes. And that, again, seems to be shifting some of the political landscape and the discussion in ways that we just didn't see, even after, you know, massively devastating storms like Katrina. And you were telling me about this Washington Post article recently on North Carolina. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I have some family that lives in North Carolina. And so, you know, we were in conversations with them about Florence and, you know, so that touched on climate change. And, you know, we just got into these conversations about, I don't want to say standard conversations you get into when storms and climate change come up. But the Washington Post article was really, really interesting. And it sort of focused on, you know, sort of a shift that you're starting to see, especially from members of the Republican Party, about their quote unquote belief in climate change. And, you know, one stat in the article that was really interesting was sort of an increase in sort of belief in climate change due to the storm. There was sort of more buy-in from sort of Republicans. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is a state that had previously legislated away discussions of climate change, right? And so this is kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And I think, you know, once those impacts hit, once they are at your front door, you know, it's hard to ignore them. They become tangible.
And so in general, the conversation seems to be, you know, framed around what's effective in getting Republicans to get on board, or for what, you know, what can scientists do to convince Republicans that climate change is real? And it is heartening to see that there seems to be a political shift if you look at the data, which is consistent with what we see more nationally, right?
Yeah. So there's some really interesting data that I was just looking at earlier today coming out of the Yale Climate Communications Group. And if you're unfamiliar with them, I highly recommend you Googling them and looking at some of their great maps.
And listening to our previous show with Jen Marlin as well. It was really one of our most popular episodes.
Yeah. And so when you look at those maps, they sort of ask questions about climate change nationally and things about legislation around climate change. And really more than half the country, when you look at their statistics, more than half the country thinks Congress should address global warming. And you know, we're even seeing things like 85%, more than 85% of people want to have rebates for energy efficient vehicles. And so I think, you know, I think there's a hunger out there to deal with this, and a growing hunger. In my class, I've showed even a shift from 2016 to 2018in the map. So change can occur as long as people are willing to engage with that change.
Yeah. It also just really speaks to, you know, we've had Catherine Hayhoe on the show before, and she often talks about how you can reach people where they are, and if the desired outcomes are the same, it doesn't really matter how they get there. And so thinking in terms of if someone installs solar panels on their farm because they're saving money, then there's this extra benefit of reducing emissions, even if that person doesn't believe in the connection between human-produced emissions and a warming planet, right? The ending outcomes are the same. And we have cleaner air. Even if it turns out that this whole climate change thing isn't real, then, you know, we still all benefit from that. And so I think framing the discussion around these sort of shared goals and the things that we can come together around, I think, is a really good way to go.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't know how things are in Nebraska, but fall is in full swing here in Maine. And to me, it feels like the more colorful the leaves get, the more the lawn signs have been popping up along the roadsides. You know, speaking of feeling like you just can't really turn anywhere and get away from this election, which is probably a good thing. But something really feels palpably different about this election year. For one, in the wake of a series of really devastating hurricanes and this depressing IPCC report, it feels like climate change has been really front and center in this election. And there's also this incredible sense of urgency. I know a lot of my friends and colleagues are feeling really angry and often very helpless right now. And a lot of us are feeling like we're not maybe being heard by our elected officials. And so voting feels for many of us like a rare opportunity to set things right, maybe to reclaim our voices and, you know, just to remind our elected officials, you know, who got them into office in the first place. But on the other hand, a lot of us are really tired. And after more than 2 years of sustained civic engagement, you know, marching, calling, writing, volunteering, donating, maybe you're wondering, like me, at some point in your darkest hour, if all of this work is worth it. Maybe you're even feeling small, maybe insignificant, possibly too insignificant to make a difference. And I'm not going to lie, that's how I was feeling last night. I'm generally a go-getter, a doer, a fixer, but sometimes I feel depressed and anxious about the state of the world. And last night was pretty rough. The news about the latest attacks on trans and intersex rights, on top of everything else that's been going on, just, you know, felt like too much. I was hearing from some of my really good friends that are directly affected by this, and they were having a hard time. And I just was wondering, you know, how can any one of us make a difference? What is the point? Should I just stop caring and focus on my science and play video games and stay off of the internet forever just for the sake of my own mental health? And so I made a choice. I took a time out. I had a long hot bath. I felt sorry for myself for a while. I ate some Vietnamese food. And then I watched Won't You Be My Neighbor? I don't know if you've seen this, but it's this recent documentary about Mr. Rogers, of all things. And so if you grew up on a steady diet of PBS as a kid, like I did, you probably grew up hearing his message. You've made this day a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are. Now, when I say it, it sounds incredibly cheesy, but when Mr. Rogers was saying it, I was in tears because so many of us needed to hear that message when we were kids. And so many of us still need to hear that message now as adults. And Mr. Rogers told us very precisely what he meant by that word, special. He didn't mean that we're all above average, as the joke goes. He meant that we all have inherent value, that we have worth, and that our worth is not determined by our productivity, how much money we make. We're born with that value, and nobody can take it away. And I've been hearing a lot lately about how the solution to climate change isn't about individual actions. It's about fighting institutions and the corporations who are the biggest polluters. But the more I think about this, that framework makes me really uncomfortable. I actually don't think it's about either of those things. It's not just individual actions. It's not just fighting institutions. The solution to climate change is about collective action. If we say our individual actions don't matter, we're literally giving up our voices and our power. Just like those ants that build a raft in a flood, or the cells that make up our bodies, we are much more than the sum of our parts. No one ant can carry an entire colony, and it takes more than one cell to make up a human heart. But when they work together, they can make a difference. And so can we. So our guest today gets this in a deep way, and is working to make change around collective action, specifically around voting. So Nathaniel Stinnett is a founder of the Environmental Voter Project in 2015. After working for more than a decade as a senior advisor, consultant, and trainer for various political campaigns and issue advocacy nonprofits, he's been called the voting guru by Grist magazine and is a frequent speaker on cutting edge campaign techniques and using behavioral science to get people to vote. Nathaniel, I'm really excited to have you on the show today. I have never seen so much discussion about get out the vote efforts around a midterm election. So we're really happy to have you here and excited to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Jacqueline. And thank you, Ramesh. I'm really excited to be here with you guys.
So do you feel like we're seeing something different in this election? We keep hearing all these projections about how college students are really going to vote this time, and the projected voter turnout is really high in various places. And I think I just read an article that my home state of Vermont has something like a 92% voter registration rate for the state, which is crazy awesome. So do you feel like something's different? Are we going to see a shift from the recent past?
Yes. I absolutely feel like something is different. Our field director just told me about an hour ago that 1 million people have already voted in Florida. So Florida has early voting. And their in-person early voting hasn't started yet. So all of these people are people who requested that ballots be mailed to them and have already mailed them back in. And just to put that number in context, just to give you a denominator, I think barely 6 million people voted in the 2014 midterms in Florida.
Wow.
So the fact that 1 million people have already voted means something's going on. Now, who are those people? That I can't tell you. I can't tell you with whether these are young people storming the polls or liberals or conservatives. I don't know, but you're right that there's a new energy going on this time around.
So speaking of demographics, I mean, you focus mostly on kind of an untapped group, the environmental movement. And we often think of environmentalists as really active in terms of making lifestyle choices. You know, giving up meat and dairy or abandoning your car for a bicycle, that takes a lot of effort and a lot more than going to the polls. So my question for you is, how are we doing? Are we actually voting as a group?
Ah, Jacqueline, you ask the $64,000 question. No, we're not. We're not.
Wow.
Environmentalists are awful voters. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We've done a lot of research on this, and it's pretty easy to measure because whether you vote or not, and a lot of Americans don't know this, whether you vote or not is public record. Now, I'll never be able to look up who Ramesh voted for or who Jacqueline voted for, but I can absolutely look up which elections you vote in and which elections you don't. And so people are able to run large polls and build predictive models and identify all the environmentalists in various states. And it turns out that environmentalists habitually undervote. They vote far less often than the average voter in almost every other state. And just to give you some context here, I'll use, say, the 2016 presidential election as an example. In 2016, 69% of registered voters voted, but only 50% of environmentalists did.
Wow.
Yeah. And if you go back to 2014, it's even worse. 44% of registered voters voted, but only 21% of environmentalists did.
Okay. So the obvious follow-up question there is why?
Yeah. Why? Well,
is that like the $135,000 question? Yeah,
that's right. That's $64,001. That question. So we know some of the reasons, but only some of the reasons. So part of what's going on here is just demographic correlations. So I don't know what the environmental movement was like 10, 20, 30 years ago, but it certainly isn't now what people imagine as the stereotypical environmentalist. The typical environmentalist now is not, well, it's not me. It's not some white yuppie who hops into their electric vehicle to get to their job downtown. People who deeply care about climate and the environment are now much more likely to make less than $50,000 a year, be African American or Latino, and live within 5 miles of an urban core. And they are predominantly younger, but that's not so much the case anymore. And all of those demographic groups that I just mentioned right now vote less often than the average American. So part of what's going on here is just that environmentalists are likely to be part of demographic groups that just habitually undervote. But the really interesting thing is that's not all that's going on here, because even if you look at just young people, environmentalists vote less often than the other young people. Or even if you look just at Latinos, the environmental Latinos vote less often than the other Latinos. So something else is going on here. And the honest answer, guys, is we don't know what it is. Because it's really easy for behavioral scientists to measure why someone takes an action. So it's really easy to set up an experiment to figure out how to get someone to vote. What's really hard is to figure out the opposite. What's really hard is to set up an experiment to figure out why people don't take an action, like exercising or voting or vaccinating their children or something like that. The best you can do is ask them. And when we ask environmentalists why they're not voting, they lie their pants off. They lie their pants off. And so, and I'm happy
to go into detail. More than other people or?
So no, not more than other people. And that's a good question. But no, I mean, no matter how you ask the question, if you try to determine why people don't vote, the responses they'll give are responses that they think you want to hear. What we've realized is that even non-voters still buy into the societal norm that voting's a good thing. So everybody wants to be known as a voter. Just like everybody wants you to think that they brush their teeth or wash their hands every time or something like that. Voting is a societal norm that we all buy into. And so when you ask people why they don't vote, they will often, before they even give you an excuse, guys, they will lie their pants off and say, oh no, I vote all the time, Jacqueline. And we know that's a lie because whether you vote or not is public record.
Right.
We will poll these people looking at their voting histories, and we know that they've never voted in their entire lives. And they swear up and down all the time that they vote whenever there's an election. And so the honest answer to your question, and it's a good one, is we don't know why environmentalists aren't voting, but we've got some good ideas as to how to get them to vote.
So Nathaniel, how do you not get, you know, you see this information, you know, you think maybe it's a demographic correlation, but you dig into the data and you're still seeing this lower voter turnout amongst environmentalists. I guess I have two questions. A, are those self-identified environmentalists? And then B, how do you not get depressed when you see that data?
So to answer your first question, yes, these are people, and obviously there are a million and one ways to define an environmentalist. We go after, we identify people who list climate change or some other environmental issue as either their number one or number two priority. And then to get to your second question, the way that we're able to identify these people is not because there are lists somewhere that you can go by of all the super environmentalists. What we do is we start by polling tens of thousands of people per state. These are enormous polls. And what we do is we simply ask people, what's your number one most important political priority? What's your number two most important political priority? And once we isolate those super environmentalists in a state, we then work with data scientists to look at these people's behavioral data and consumer data and the data that's on the voter files. And we build models, we build predictive models that help us figure out who all the other environmentalists are in a state. And I know that sounds really complicated and convoluted, but it's how every political campaign now targets voters. And it's actually not that different from what, say, insurance companies do. Right? Like you apply for life insurance and you need to say, oh, you know, this is how much I drink. This is how much I smoke. No, I don't like to dive off cliffs. You know, you give them all this data about yourself and they use that information to work with actuarial tables and, well, and not to get morbid, but they need to figure out how long you're going to live.
Right.
And if they're off, like just by a little bit, they lose billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So the insurance company has figured this out and we do the same thing, but instead of trying to figure out how long you're going to live, we try to identify all of the super environmentalists in a state.
So I guess that leads into a sort of a follow-up question. Does the voter data sort of break down? You said, you know, you asked them if climate change is a number one issue or a number two issue. Does it break down on different environmental issues that might not be climate change? You know, how nuanced do you get in terms of their environmental issues? Or is the environment important to you, number one or number two?
Right. So it's really the latter.
Okay.
We are not a climate change only organization. And that's for a few reasons. I think the biggest of which is, I think a lot of these environmental issues are intertwined, and it's often a fool's errand to pretend otherwise. But no, we are an environmental voter turnout organization. And if someone says that wildlife conservation or clean air is their number one priority or their number two priority, we'll turn those people out, just like we'll turn someone out who says climate change is their number one priority.
Right.
So sometimes we do have that data. Sometimes we do have the breakdowns. But when it all goes through all of our algorithms and we figure out who we're going to target, we're going to turn out the marine biologist who cares about clean oceans, just like we're going to turn out the hipster in Brooklyn who cares about climate change.
Right, right. So I guess speaking of turnout, you are targeting a lot of different environmentalists. So if you want to get them to the polls, what have you found works?
Yeah, this is the interesting thing, Ramesh. What the Environmental Voter Project does not do is talk about the environment, for a few good reasons. The biggest of which is it doesn't work. Now, I want to be clear about what we're doing here. What we're not doing is trying to persuade people to care about these issues. Remember, we're already preaching to the choir. We've found people who, if you shake them awake at night, they're going to scream climate change. Like, these are super environmentalists, right?
Right.
But they're not voting. And so we can afford to be completely agnostic in our messaging. I mean, we would talk about chocolate chip cookies if it got these people to vote.
Sure.
And what we've realized, and it's not just us, other behavioral scientists have realized this too. We've realized that the best way to turn a non-voter into a voter is not to try to rationally convince them of the value of their vote because of the issue that they care about. Instead, we take advantage of how they want to view themselves, of the type of person they want to be. And then we apply peer pressure and social pressure trying to get them to vote. And I know that sounds a little creepy, and it is. and I know it sounds a little juvenile, and it is. But this
But there's a reason it worked in middle school.
That's right. This is why all the fourth graders, like, you know, said this stuff on the playground. It's because it works. I mean, how many of you have suddenly lost 5 pounds because someone told you one fact? Or maybe you started brushing your teeth because someone told you a fact. Like, no, that's not how you change people's behavior. And we know that in so many other contexts. But when it comes to politics or trying to convince people about climate change, we often fall into this trap that the 17th fact that we bash them over the head with is finally going to get them to do something. And the truth is, the best way we've found to get people to vote is to say things like, Jacqueline, did you know last time there was an election, 93 people on your block of Main Street turned out to vote?
Hmm.
We simply say that. Or we'll send a letter to you, Ramesh, and we'll say, Ramesh, I want to remind you that who you vote for is secret, but whether you vote or not is public record. And in fact, you'll see below that we've included a copy of your public voting history.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, wow is right. We really turn the screws. But what's amazing is this stuff sends turnout through the roof. And, you know, I'm not a policy guy. I sound silly even saying this to the two of you. We all know that the climate crisis is not a small thing. And if using some of these peer pressure and social pressure and behavioral science techniques can get hundreds of thousands of environmentalists to start voting, you're damn right I'm going to use them. Like, absolutely.
Well, it's so interesting to me because I feel like there are so many themes and threads that we keep touching on this show. And one of them is this idea of what's called the deficit model in science communication or in teaching. The idea being that people will change their behavior or they will learn something better if you just give them more facts, which, as you've said, doesn't work. And we know it doesn't work. And it's deeply uncomfortable to me as an educator that this doesn't work, right? Because we're sort of trained to just give students more information and more facts, and then, you know, hope that they will make better decisions as citizens or that they'll do better on the exam. And it turns out that so much of what you need to do to change behavior comes down to psychology. It comes down to empathy and storytelling and these sort of more squishy approaches that involve feelings and not data or facts. And it sounds like you're saying something like these are the same principles that are underlying what's effective from your point of view. And so I'm wondering, you know, your background is as an attorney, you're working on these Get Out the Vote campaigns, but it sounds like you're leveraging a lot of psychology here. And how do you, did you just grow up knowing this stuff? Or how did you learn more about how people tick in order to be able to do the work that you do?
Right, right. So it's a great question. And the answer is no, I did not grow up knowing this stuff. And you're right that we are one of these sort of weird environmental nonprofits that really doesn't do any environmental policy work. We really are behavioral scientists. All we really do are data science and behavioral science. And I came to this in kind of a roundabout way. So you're right that I was an attorney, but while I was in law school and all through while I was practicing law, I helped run, you know, either as a campaign manager or a senior strategist, political campaigns, big and small, from U.S. Senate races down to little city council and state rep races. And I was always deeply frustrated by one thing, and it's something that both of you are probably painfully familiar with. When you poll likely voters in any election, and you ask them to list their top priorities, climate change and other environmental issues are way, way down towards the bottom of that list.
Hmm. Yeah.
Now, in your open, you started talking about how this year was a little different, and I'm excited to talk about that because I think you might be right that things are changing. But certainly up until now, whether you're talking about a race for president or a race for city council, when you poll likely voters, climate change and the environment is way, way down their list of priorities. And that has an enormous impact on how policy is made. Because even when we elect the right people, even when we elect great environmentalists, there's no way in hell they're going to push hard and spend their political capital on something that voters don't care about. They're just right. Not. And this always frustrated me as I was running these campaigns. And something really interesting happened about four, now almost 5 years ago. I finished running a mayoral campaign in Boston and was taking some time off before what I thought would be going back to my law firm, and was waiting for our first child to be born. And I stumbled across some polling data for what was then the 2014 midterms. And what I started to see in this polling data was that although when you poll voters, climate change and the environment is way down their list of priorities, that's not quite what you see when you poll all Americans. When you poll all American adults or even all registered voters, I won't claim that climate change is up near the top. Of course it isn't. But it's a little bit closer to the middle. I started looking at more and more polling data, and I started to see the same trend. And I thought, huh, what if the environmental movement doesn't have a persuasion problem as much as we have a turnout problem? What if there are a whole bunch of environmentalists who don't need to have their minds changed, they just need their behavior changed? And because I had some time off, because I was waiting for our kid to be born and then I was going to be on paternity leave, I started to dig into a lot of the behavioral science that we had just begun to use in some of the campaigns that I was working on, and really started to see that there were a whole lot of techniques that campaigns were beginning to use, but no one was truly diving into them, largely because a political campaign at best lasts 9 months or 12 months. And so I started teaching myself, and I started talking to behavioral psychologists and other behavioral scientists and really learning the best ways not to persuade people, not to change anybody's mind, but to change their habits, to change their behavior, because that's what I decided the environmental movement really, really needed at this moment in time.
I think that's a really powerful distinction, because so often I hear from people who feel really isolated in, or like they care about the environment, but they feel very depressed about it, and the situation in the world and politically just makes them feel really down about their connection to the environment, the natural world. And to know that there's potentially a very large group of people out there that just aren't stepping up, I feel like that could really push back against some of this sort of existential angst or environmental depression that people feel, because you're sort of reminding them that, hey, you're not alone. There are a lot more people out there. There's just, it's a lot less energy to get people to take one day, you know, to go to a ballot box than to convince them that they should care about an issue, if that makes sense. So if it feels to me like there's all this low hanging fruit and we could actually make some traction on environmental issues if you could just get environmentalists to the polls. It's not this monumental task of having to convince people that the environment is in danger and that they need to care about it.
I think that also puts the ideas that we talked about at the beginning, sort of those Yale climate communication maps, into a different context as well. When you ask people, do they think the environment is important, or should Congress legislate, or should CO2 be regulated as a pollutant? You know, I think they have all those ideas. The assumption is almost like, okay, great, you guys think this is important. You know, there's a change in, there's a shift in people's priorities on that. But, you know, maybe we're not asking the right questions. Maybe they have those opinions, but there's not the kick in the pants to get them to vote. You know, they recognize the importance of it, but we're just making the assumption that they think it's important, so they're going to vote. And maybe that seems to be the space that the EVP seems to be filling. Is that an appropriate sort of characterization?
I think that's exactly right. I don't think either of you will be surprised, nor will any of your listeners be surprised to hear that politicians couldn't possibly care less about non-voters. I mean, right. why on earth should they care about non-voters, right?
Right.
I mean, we wouldn't expect Starbucks to care about you if you don't drink coffee. Why would a politician care about the opinions and priorities of non-voters? And again, I know I mentioned this earlier, but it bears repeating, because it is the lifeblood of how modern campaigns work. Who you vote for is secret, but whether you vote or not is public record. It's public record. So let's say Jacqueline is running for governor of Maine. And Jacqueline, for better or for worse, you hire me to be your campaign manager. How would you feel if on election day, I sheepishly walk up to you and say, Jacqueline, I hate to admit this, but you know what? I spent all your money talking to people I'm pretty sure aren't going to vote.
It'd be pretty salty.
Yes, you'd probably be pretty salty.
To use a crusty New Englander term.
Right. And surprise, surprise, political campaigns take the approach of they look at public voter files, and with their limited time and limited money, they only talk to and they only measure the opinions of people who are consistent voters. And so that is at once why this turnout problem in the environmental movement is such a big problem, but also such a huge opportunity. And this gets to what you were saying, Jacqueline. You're absolutely right that changing minds is so much harder than changing behavior. And the fact that there are all of these yet to be activated environmentalists out there is an enormous opportunity for us. I mean, you know what would be bad news? What would be bad news is if I said, hey guys, we've done lots of polls and it turns out no one cares about climate change. We're all screwed. Like that would suck, right?
Right, right.
because changing everybody's mind is damn near impossible. But that's not what's going on. What's going on here is that we've found tens of millions of already persuaded, dyed-in-the-wool super environmentalists out there who are already even registered to vote. We're just not showing up the few times each year where it's important. And if we start doing that, nothing can stop us. And I don't mean that in a kumbaya type of way. That's not the type of guy I am, believe me. I mean it in a very cynical way. Politicians go where the votes are. It's just that simple. Politicians go where the votes are. It's the simple arithmetic of how elections work. Either you go where the votes are or you don't get to be a politician anymore. And so if all of these environmentalists start voting, my gosh, local and state and federal officials will fall all over themselves to lead on these issues, because nothing motivates a politician more than the prospect of winning or losing an election.
So Nathaniel, I'll ask, so at the EVP, you mentioned that you're, you know, I was doing a little homework on the EVP, and it's a nonpartisan organization. So you're not necessarily targeting Democrats or Republicans. You're just saying, hey, we noticed that you haven't voted in a while, or we noticed that you're not trying to lead anyone towards a particular candidate or towards a particular agenda.
That's exactly right. We are confident that as long as politicians want to win political campaigns, they will respond to environmental issues if tons of environmentalists start voting. It's like, you know, if you drive 5,000 coffee drinkers to the door of Starbucks, believe me, they'll start making more coffee. So our approach is, let's find all the people who don't just kind of sort of care about the environment, but all the people who care about it so deeply that it's their number one or number two priority, whether they're independent, whether they're liberal, whether they're conservative, no matter who they are, and turn them from non-voters or people who vote very seldom into consistent voters. Because that is going to bring real lasting change. Because again, politicians have to go where the votes are. They have to, or else they're not going to be politicians anymore.
So what you're saying is I should just be shaming my friends then into voting. I mean, this is why we wear the stickers, right? I mean, I always thought like, oh, the stickers are fun. You know, they make me feel excited, like I'm part of something, but they have this other role too, right? They're, if you're not wearing a sticker, then, you know, people are going to notice, right? And, but it literally sounds like the most effective thing that I could be doing is basically shaming my friends into voting.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Peer pressure works. There are, and I feel silly explaining this to two scientists who are going to shame me with their far superior knowledge on this stuff, but one of the things, if not the thing, that makes human beings truly unique as a species is not, you know, opposable thumbs or a really big cranium or something like that. We are hyper-social beings. I mean, even just over the last 10, 15,000 years, what is truly extraordinary is that we've moved from creating sort of family unit norms to enormous societal norms that are shared by tens of millions of people who will never, ever, ever see each other. That is what is so extraordinarily unique about us. And these norms are so sticky. We want to adhere to them so much. And so, yes, peer pressure and other forms of social pressure drive our behavior in extraordinary ways. And I'll give you an example that you guys probably are aware of if you've ever volunteered for any political campaign ever.
Yes.
Oh, good. Good. You both should. Chances are you've gone to some voter's door and you've asked them if they intend to vote. And then they say, yeah. And then maybe as a follow-up, you say, oh, well, will you sign this card saying that you're going to vote and we're going to mail it back to you?
Yep,
it's called a pledge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is a very simple technique, right? But there's actually some really sophisticated behavioral science underneath it. The reason this works, the reason asking someone to pledge to vote and then reminding them of that pledge, the reason that works is not because the voter needs a reminder of the election. But it's because one of the stickiest societal norms, not just in the United States, but anywhere, is that we all want to be viewed as honest, trustworthy people. And so if you show someone in their own handwriting that they promise to do something, their likelihood of actually doing it shoots through the roof. And that's a simple thing. And when it gets down to it, that's all that we do at the Environmental Voter Project. We search for these societal norms that people want to adhere to, but aren't adhering to.
So and we go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And we use that difference. We take advantage of that to try to change their behavior. So we try to trick people into saying that they're going to vote. And then we remind them that they promised to vote. Or we go up to people who aren't voting and we remind them that whether they vote or not is public record, or, you know, little things like that. But these little behavioral nudges can create enormous changes in turnout.
So it's interesting that you're taking sort of a two-pronged approach, right? That there's sort of the sign the pledge and in your own handwriting. And so now be your best self and live up to your own expectation, which is really sort of a positive way to get people to the polls. And then there's sort of the other side of it, where you're sort of, you're showing them the public records of their own voting, and you're sort of shaming them into getting to the polls. It's an interesting sort of dichotomy coming at that issue from two directions.
That's right. We are not afraid of using shame. we certainly use both a carrot and a stick. And some of the techniques work better with some people than others. And we're kind of like a permanent field laboratory. And we're always testing different techniques and different messages and even different fonts and things like that, trying to figure out, okay, what type of message delivered in what manner works best among this group of people versus that group of people. And sometimes the carrot works and sometimes the stick works.
Have there been particular demographics where particular carrots have worked particularly well?
Yeah. So we've done some experiments with what's called thank you mail. So if you have an election calendar where your primary is very close to your general election, what we've been able to do is see who voted in the primary, then immediately send them letters thanking them for voting. Now, that's not 100% carrot, right? Like, it's also a little bit creepy and a little bit Orwellian. And it's us saying, hey, we know that you voted. But a lot of people love getting it. They love having that good behavior reinforced. And we've found that after doing that, it stays sticky. Even beyond that next general election, when you get into the next year's local elections and sleepy little elections, if people know that someone is essentially watching them and every now and then that person will thank them for being a good voter, that has an enormous amount of power.
Right. Yeah.
So this is how, I mean, to circle back to one of our early questions, like this is how you don't get depressed when you see the data on voter turnouts, because you know that with just a little bit of effort, things could be so much better.
That's exactly right, Jacqueline. And again, I feel silly saying this to people who know it very, very well, but what the climate crisis is not is some disease for which we have no cure. Mm-hmm. And it is not some enemy that we can't possibly defeat. I mean, we have so many of the solutions that we need. And what we're largely missing is political will. What we're largely missing is the political leadership at the local, state, and federal level to enact these things. And so when I see this enormous army of latent political power, this enormous army of potential environmental voters, it's enormously hopeful. It's so hopeful because simply by showing up, we won't just change who we elect, although that's obviously a nice thing. But no matter whom we elect, they're going to lead on these issues if we start voting. And I think that's so important for people to understand. So many people in today's cynical political world think that their vote doesn't matter. And they couldn't be more wrong. Because of the public nature of the voter file, your vote is the only thing that matters. I mean, there are 255 million adults in the United States today, but only 83 million of them voted in the 2014 midterms. Who do you think members of Congress care about when they're setting our political agenda? Do you think they care about all the people who didn't vote? No way. And that's why it's so important for environmentalists to vote in every election, even if you write your dog's name in on the ballot. Like, simply by voting, you become a first-class citizen. And that is really empowering. And I think it's so important for environmentalists to start viewing the act of voting as one of the highest forms of environmental citizenship, because it's such an easy way to have an impact on policymaking.
I think that is an incredible place to end. That's such a strong and powerful message and an empowering message in a time when I think we all need that so very badly. So I would just say thank you so much for sharing just a little of your wisdom with us and also for motivating people to go out there and shame their friends into voting.
It's my pleasure. And I loved chatting with you guys. And yes, you're right, Jacqueline. Everybody should go out and shame their friends into voting. Absolutely.
That's the message in the fortune cookie today. Shame your friends into voting.
That's
you're right.
You
heard here, folks. So we'd like to end the show on a little Ask Me Anything feature that we've started doing over the summer. And our question comes from Joe Stormer on Twitter. He asks, is it true that glacier-laden land like Greenland or Iceland actually rises in relation to the ocean when the climate is warmer, even though sea levels have risen? So I'm going to field this one, Ramesh, if that's
yeah.
all right.
No, that's all you.
Cool. So the answer is simply yes. So any place that you have had ice in the past, in the recent past, the weight of that ice, if the ice was thick enough, is going to actually be so heavy that it can depress the crust, the Earth's crust. So if you imagine you've just taken like a really nice warm chocolate cake out of the oven and it's, you know, you haven't frosted it yet and you take your thumb and you press into that nice warm sponge cake, then eventually that thumbprint will start to kind of rise and move back to its original position, right? So similarly, the Earth's crust is kind of bendy and malleable on this large scale. And as the weight of the ice is lifted, as the ice itself melts, then there's a rebound. It's called isostatic rebound that happens in that place. And so, for example, here where I live in Maine, I live close to Acadia National Park, and the tallest mountain is Cadillac Mountain. And Cadillac is actually getting a little bit higher every year because even though the ice here has been gone for 15,000 years, we're still rebounding after the weight of that incredibly heavy ice sheet. So when you think about sea level rise in relation to glaciers and ice age cycles, the story actually can be really complicated. So for example, here in Maine, as soon as the ice retreated, we were underwater because of that depression from the glaciers. And then as the glaciers melted, this process of rebound started happening. And so Cadillac Mountain, you know, poked out of the ocean, became a little tiny island, and then eventually became part of the bigger interconnected island that is Mount Desert Island today. So yes, glacier-laden land can rise in relation to the ocean, even though the climate is warmer. So sea level is rising here in Maine, and now we're starting to see that sea level is rising faster than that isostatic rebound. So even though the land is lifting a little bit, ocean levels are rising faster than that. So we can't count on that rebound to buffer us against future rising sea levels. All right. So hopefully
that was a great question.
Yeah, that was
Thanks,
a really
y'all.
Good question.
Yeah.
Hopefully that made sense. I love nerding out about glaciers. And so with that, I'd like to end our show. And I'd like to bookend us with another Mr. Rogers quote, because that's the kind of 80s child that I am. And this one I actually came across when I was an adult. And I love this. It's, when I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. And I take a lot from that quote, both in terms of being able to trust that I don't have to fix all the problems. I can work on the problems that I'm suited to work on, and all of my wonderful colleagues and friends are also helping too. And it's a nudge to me to remind me to try to be that helper whenever I can. So I'm going to ask you, your homework for next time is to find some way to be a helper. And sure, shame your friends into voting, but see if there's something else that you can do to kind of push back against that sense of personal despair. And we'd love to hear from you in terms of what you have found to do to make a difference in your communities and your workplaces and schools, et cetera. And we are always looking for sponsors to help out our amazing producers who run the show as complete volunteers. And we also love to hear from you, our listeners. So please follow us on Twitter at Our Warm Regards. You can also email us ideas for future guests or shows, feedback about how we're doing, or send us some Ask Me Anything questions to ourwarmregards@gmail.com. Please subscribe to the show. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you can take an extra step and give us a review, that helps us out a lot as well.
That's kind of like voting.
It's exactly like voting. I'm going to shame you into leaving us a review. You know, 95% of our listeners leave reviews for the show. That's not, I made that quote up. show notes with links and resources can be found on our new Medium page, which has some links to the things we've talked about in the show. For my co-host, Ramesh, our guests, Nathaniel, and our producers, Eric Mack and Jesse Ann Baines, thank you for listening. Be well.